I am Neo. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today is September 27th, 2009. The website is theskepticarena.com. Today's subject, prominent alumni and professors criticize Yale for removing Muslim cartoons from upcoming book. Yale University has removed cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad from an upcoming book about how they caused outrage across the Muslim world, drawing criticism from prominent alumni and a national group of university professors. Yale University Press, which the university owns, removed 12 caricatures from the book, The Cartoons That Shook the World, by Brandeis University professor Jit Clausen. The book is scheduled to be released next week. A Danish newspaper originally published the cartoons, including one depicting Muhammad wearing a bomb-shaped turban in 2005. Other Western publications reprinted them. The following year, the cartoons triggered massive protests from Morocco to Indonesia. Rioters torched Danish and other Western diplomatic missions. Some Muslim countries boycotted Danish products. Islamic law generally opposes any depiction of the Prophet, even favorable, for fear it could lead to idolatry. Michael Sternberg, an attorney and Yale graduate, said, "I think it's horrifying that the campus of Nathan Hale has become the first place where America surrenders to this kind of fear because of what extremists might possibly do." Steinberg was among 25 alumni who signed a protest letter sent Friday to Yale Alumni Magazine that urged the university to restore the drawings to the book. Other signers included John Bolton, a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under President George W. Bush, former Bush administration speechwriter David Frum, and Seth Corey, a liberal doctor. "I think it's intellectual cowardice," Bolton said. "I think it's very self-defeating on Yale's part. To me, it's just inexplicable." Kerry Nelson, president of the American Association of University Professors, wrote in a recent letter that Yale's decision effectively means we do not negotiate with terrorists. We just accede to their anticipated demands. In a statement explaining the decision, Yale University Press said it decided to exclude a Danish newspaper page of the cartoons and other depictions of Muhammad after asking the university for help on the issue. It said the university consulted counterterrorism officials, diplomats, and the top Muslim official at the United Nations. The decision rested solely on the experts' assessment that there existed a substantial likelihood of violence that might take the lives of innocent victims. Republication of the cartoons has repeatedly resulted in violence around the world, leading to more than 200 deaths and hundreds of injuries. It also noted that major newspapers in the United States and Britain have declined to print the cartoons. Yale and Yale University Press are deeply committed to freedom of speech and expression. Excuse me, listeners, I couldn't hold that in. Continuing, "So the issues raised here were difficult," the statement said. "The press would never have reached the decision it did on the grounds that some might be offended by portrayals of the Prophet Muhammad." I'm still trying to recover from that statement about how deeply committed they are to freedom of speech and expression. It's just mind-boggling that they even had the nerve to say that. John Donatich, director of Yale University Press, said the critics are grandstanding. He said it was not a case of censorship because the university did not suppress original content that was not available in other places. "I would never have agreed to censor original content," Donatich said. What a weasel. That's called rationalization. Continuing, Clausen was surprised by the decision when she learned of it last week. She said scholarly reviewers and Yale's publication committee, comprised of faculty, recommended the cartoons be included. Clausen said, "I'm extremely upset about that." "The experts Yale consulted did not read the manuscript," Clausen said. She said she consulted the Muslim leaders and did not believe including the cartoons in a scholarly debate would spark violence. Clausen said she reluctantly agreed to have the book published without the images because she did not believe any other university press would publish them, and she hopes Yale will include them in later editions. She argues in the book that there is a misperception that Muslims spontaneously arose in anger over the cartoons when they really were symbols manipulated by those already involved in violence. Donatich said there wasn't time for the experts to read the book, but they were told of the context. He said reviewers and the publications committee did not object, but were not asked about the security risk. Many Muslim nations want to restrict speech to prevent insults to Islam they claim have proliferated since the terrorist attacks in the United States on September 11, 2001. Fareed Zakaria, editor of Newsweek International, a world affairs columnist and CNN host who serves on Yale's governing board, said he told Yale that he believed publishing the images would have provoked violence. As a journalist and public commentator, I believe deeply in the First Amendment and academic freedom. I'm sorry, listeners. I just can't hold it in when I hear bold-faced lies. I can't even imagine how he can have the nerve to make statements like that. Obviously, he does not believe very deeply in the First Amendment and academic freedom. Zakaria said, but in this instance, Yale Press was confronted with a clear threat of violence and loss of life. So that's great. We'll just back down and give up all of the centuries of hard-fought freedoms so that we don't offend those people who are going to threaten to kill us. Let's move to the science segment before I lose my lunch. Today's story, a one-way ticket to Mars. Now that the hype surrounding the 40th anniversary of the moon landings has come and gone, we are faced with the grim reality that if we want to send humans back to the moon, the investment is likely to run in excess of $150 billion. The cost to get to Mars could easily be 2 to 4 times that, if it is possible at all. This is the issue being wrestled with by a NASA panel convened this year and led by Norman Augustine, a former chief executive of Lockheed Martin, that will in the coming weeks present President Obama with options for the near-term future of human spaceflight. It is quickly becoming clear that going to the moon or Mars in the next decade or two will be impossible without a much bigger budget than has so far been allocated. Is it worth it? The most challenging impediment to human travel to Mars does not seem to involve the complicated launching, propulsion, guidance, or landing technologies, but something far more mundane, the radiation emanating from the sun's cosmic rays. The shielding necessary to ensure the astronauts do not get a lethal dose of solar radiation on a round trip to Mars may very well make the spacecraft so heavy that the amount of fuel needed becomes prohibitive. There is, however, a way to surmount this problem while reducing the cost and technical requirements, but it demands that we ask this vexing question: why are we so interested in bringing the Mars astronauts home again? While the idea of sending astronauts aloft, never to return, is jarring upon first hearing, the rationale for one-way trips into space has both historical and practical roots. Colonists and pilgrims seldom set off for the New World with the expectation of a return trip, usually because the places they were leaving were pretty intolerable anyway. Give us a century or two here on Earth, and we may turn the whole planet into a place from which many people might be happy to depart. Moreover, one of the reasons that is sometimes given for sending humans into space is that we need to move beyond Earth if we are to improve our species' chances of survival, should something terrible happen back home. This requires people to leave and stay away. There are more immediate and pragmatic reasons to consider one-way human space exploration missions. First, money. Much of the cost of a voyage to Mars will be spent on coming home again. If the fuel for the return is carried on the ship, this greatly increases the mass of the ship, which in turn requires even more fuel. The president of the Mars Society, Robert Zubrin, has offered one possible solution: 2 ships, sent separately. The first would be sent unmanned, and once there, combine onboard hydrogen with carbon dioxide from the Martian atmosphere to generate the fuel for the return trip. The second would take the astronauts there and then be left behind. But once arrival is decoupled from return, one should ask whether the return trip is really necessary. Surely, if the point of sending astronauts is to be able to carry out scientific experiments that robots cannot do, then the longer they spend on the planet, the more experiments they can do. Moreover, if the radiation problems cannot be adequately resolved, then the longevity of astronauts signing up for a Mars round trip would be severely compromised in any case. As cruel as it may sound, the astronauts would probably best use their remaining time living and working on Mars rather than dying at home. If it sounds unrealistic to suggest that astronauts would be willing to leave home never to return alive, then consider the results of several informal surveys. A group of scientists and engineers from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, when asked how many would be willing to go on a one-way mission into space, every member of the group raised his hand. The lure of space travel remains intoxicating for a generation brought up on Star Trek and Star Wars. We might want to restrict the voyage to older astronauts, whose longevity is limited in any case. Here again, I have found a significant fraction of scientists older than 65 who would be willing to live out the remaining years on the Red Planet or elsewhere. With older scientists, there would be additional health complications, to be sure, but the necessary medical personnel and equipment would still probably be cheaper than designing a return mission. Delivering food and supplies to these new pioneers, along with the tools to grow and build whatever they need for however long they live on the Red Planet, is likewise more reasonable and may be less expensive than designing a ticket home. Certainly, as in the Zubrin proposal, unmanned spacecraft could provide the crucial supply lines. The largest stumbling block to a consideration of one-way missions is probably political. NASA and Congress are unlikely to do something that could be perceived as signing the death warrants of astronauts. Nevertheless, human space travel is so expensive and so dangerous that we are going to need novel, even extreme solutions if we really want to expand the range of human civilization beyond our own planet. To boldly go where no one has gone before does not require coming home again. And now the arena goes abroad. Today we travel to Yemen, where the government defends efforts to end girls' marriages. The Yemeni government defended its efforts to end the practice of young girls marrying, citing last week's death during childbirth of a 12-year-old Yemeni girl. In a statement this week, UNICEF Director Anne Veneman assailed the deplorable violations of children's rights. Over the years, the government of Yemen has embarked on an awareness campaign to end the practice of young marriages, which has been deeply rooted in the rural cultures of Yemen. The Yemeni parliament tried in February to pass a law that would have set the minimum marriage age at 17. But conservative parliamentarians kept it from reaching the president by arguing it violates Sharia or Islamic law, which does not stipulate a minimum age. Well, if it doesn't stimulate a minimum age, how does it violate the law? Continuing, unfortunately, prior to the ratification of the amendments by the Honorable President Ali Abdullah Saleh, members of the conservative bloc in the parliament have rescinded the proposed amendments to allow for further deliberations. It is anticipated that the matter will be finalized in the near future, and it is deemed an important priority of the government. The Ministry of Health has sought to establish emergency labor clinics in rural villages with the aim of reducing infant and maternity mortality. Anne Veneman added that child marriages violate the rights of children in the most deplorable way. The younger the girl is when she becomes pregnant, the greater the health risks for her and her baby. Girls who give birth before the age of 15 are 5 times more likely to die in childbirth than women in their 20s. When they're pushed into marriage, they are pushed into early pregnancy. It's like pushing our children into the trap of death, knowingly. The girl, Faziwa Amadi, struggled for 3 days in labor before dying Friday of bleeding. Her baby also died in childbirth. Although the cause of her death was lack of medical care, the real cause was the lack of education in Yemen and the fact that child marriages keep happening. Born into an impoverished family, Fazewa was forced to drop out of school and was married off last year to a 24-year-old man. So basically, they sold their own daughter for money. What a wonderful group of human beings. Continuing, child brides are commonplace in Yemen, especially on the Red Sea coast, where tribal customs hold sway. More than half of the Yemeni girls are married off before the age of 18, many times to older men, some of whom are already married. While it is not clear why Fazewa's parents married her off, reasons for such actions typically vary. Sometimes financially strapped parents offer up their daughters for dowries. Once married, the girls are no longer a financial or moral burden to their parents. Well, isn't that what parenting means? All children are financial and moral burdens to their parents. What a bunch of subhuman pieces of garbage. Continuing, the issue of Yemeni child brides came to the forefront in 2008 when Nujood Ali, then 10 years of age, was pulled out of school and married to a man who beat and raped her within weeks of the ceremony. To escape, Nujood hailed a taxi for the first time in her life and was taken across town to the central courthouse where she demanded to see a judge. After a well-publicized trial, she was granted a divorce. After finishing that last story and vomiting up my lunch, we will now move to the final section of the show, Famous Quotes. Today, L. Ron Hubbard, born 1911, died 1986 at the age of 74. He was an American science fiction author who developed a self-help system called Dianetics, which was first published in 1950. Over the next three decades, Hubbard developed his self-help ideas into a wide-ranging set of doctrines and rituals as part of a new religion he called Scientology. Hubbard's writings became the guiding texts for the Church of Scientology and a number of affiliated organizations that address such diverse topics as business administration, literacy, and drug rehab. And now for the quote from L. Ron Hubbard. If you want to make a little money, write a book. If you want to make a lot of money, create a religion.
Are you ready, Boots? Start walking.